My name is Jody Kretzmann, and this is the second of a couple of sessions that have been ridiculously and arrogantly titled, How to End Poverty. I mentioned to those of you who were around yesterday for our first attempt at ending poverty that the idea for the title for the sessions occurred to me when I was in Crocs and Brentano's in my hometown of Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and I noticed that of the 50 people in the store, about 25 or 30 of them were clustered around the tiny corner of the bookstore that had how-to books in it. And so I figured that if you called anything you were doing how-to and put a how-to in front of it, more people would come. And I do want to talk with people about ending poverty, so I'm trying to seduce you here through the entirely false expectation that I know how to do it, right? If you come with any sort of expectation that, in fact, you're going to learn how to end poverty in this hour, let me disabuse you of that immediately. What I do want to do, though, is to invite us all into a conversation about our relationship to the poor of the United States and of the globe, and to think about the ways in which it seems to me, first of all, that 1990 is a possible sort of breaking time in our interaction with poverty. Let me ask first the question, why focus on poverty at this point in our life in the United States and as Christians in the United States, and suggest a couple of reasons. Number one, the first set of reasons having to do with the dimensions of poverty. We spent a moment yesterday, and I want to spend a moment today reviewing sort of the state of affairs, where we are as a country, just really a moment, where we are as a country and where we are globally with the question of poverty. Because it seems to me that the first reason to focus on this is that the decade of the 1980s have made things remarkably worse, both domestically and internationally in the area of poverty. Secondly, it seems to me that now is a propitious time, however, to focus on poverty because we're at a kind of watershed moment, it seems to me, in lots of parts of the globe and certainly in the United States. We've had one set of experiments about how to deal with questions of social policy, particularly having to do with poverty, really over the last 15 years, but certainly concentrated in the decade of the 80s. It seems to me that whatever one says about that decade, the Reagan era, that it has probably at best a mixed record in dealing with questions of social inequality, and probably by most measures a disastrous record. But whatever, it's over. It's over, and lots of people are rethinking at a lot of different levels, from the community, the church and the community, the neighborhood, through city hall and state government to the national level, how it is you deal with these questions. That's true in the United States. It's true even more globally. It is both frightening and terribly exciting, it seems to me, to hear about the different ways that people are reconceiving how to put the social order together, particularly in Eastern Europe and, in fact, in large parts of Latin America and Africa as well. A lot of creative thinking, it seems to me, mixing systems in ways that we haven't been able to do with our sort of ideological blinders on really for the last 30 or 40 years. So that people are talking about things like market socialism, right? One would think that that might be a kind of contradiction in terms, but that's the kind of analog to social democracy out of the capitalist world that more and more people in Eastern Europe are talking about. So it's a time when systems thinking is breaking open in new ways and inviting, it seems to me, invention and innovation on the part of those people who care, and particularly Christian people. And finally, it seems to me that this is a propitious moment to rethink poverty because we are who we are as a people of God, and that's an assumption here about most of us here at Holden, that we have a kind of special relationship to the God of the poor, that we have a kind of special relationship to a Jesus who spent most of his time not with the wealthy but with the poor, and that therefore our relationship with the poor and with the Jesus of the poor is one that we need to constantly rejuvenate, constantly pump new life, new blood into. because that's what we're called to be. Okay, let me say a word more about reason one. Things are not good for poor people on the earth, and they're getting worse. The whiteboard just arrived here, and I was going to put a couple of things on the board. Let me just do a couple of things, but just remind us of where we are at this point. Let me start with the United States. The government now tells us that it takes about, those of you who were here yesterday, I'm just going to review this very, very briefly before getting to the economic questions here. The government tells us it takes about $12,000 for a family of four to exist at above some kind of rate called the poverty line. A recent foundation study in Washington by the Family Foundation asked a lot of people in the United States what they thought was required for an absolute minimum standard of living in the United States at this point, and then added up what that would cost for a family of four. And that number, as opposed to the government number, turned out to be about $15,000, sort of more realistically. By those two counts, you get kind of different numbers about the total number of poor people, something about 32 million if you use the government number and about 46 million if you use the Family Foundation number. At any rate, something between 15 and 20% of the population of the United States is now poor. Who are the poor? Just a couple of quick reminders for all of us. We know about this. One way to think about poor people in the United States is to think about them in thirds, that about a third of the poor are elderly and disabled. For those folks, by the way, things have been getting slightly better over the last 15 years. But that's the only category of the poor for whom things have been getting slightly better, and for some subcategories. A second third are people we could sort of call the temporary poor, that is, folks who are in a newly growing group of working poor people who slide back and forth into poverty depending on the availability of work and the pay scale of work and how many members of the family have jobs and so on. But somehow they're temporarily poor, they're not locked in. And then what we have for the final third is something that's relatively new for the United States, which is a more or less permanent class of poor people. That is, people who over a period of 2, 3, 4, 5 years have been locked into a status of poverty. There's some of the hardcore poor, some people talk about the underclass and so on. There are a lot of problems with the terminology for that group, but it needs to be dealt with as a phenomenon. It's certainly real, and it's a new challenge for the United States. Another way of thinking about poverty in the United States, about a quarter of all United States children are now poor, born into poverty and exist in poverty, and about a quarter of all elderly people are poor in the United States at this point. The other thing I think that's important to just stress at the outset is that after 1950, after about 25 years of lowering the poverty rate. In 1973, we got the poverty rate in the United States, the percentage of people who were poor in the United States, down to 11%, as government figures. Since 1973, what's happened is that the poverty rate leveled out till about 1981, and since 1981, it's been rising at a slow but steady rate, so that the overall poverty rate in the United States is now about, you know, something like 16% in 1990. So after about 2.5 decades of lowering both the number, the absolute number, and the percentage of people in the United States who are poor, we find ourselves going in the opposite direction at this point. And that's certainly one thing you can say about the 1980s. And just say a word about where we are globally at this point. The global definition of poverty is different from the definition we use in the United States. It's important for us to recognize that poverty in the United States is real, but poverty in advanced industrial countries is different from poverty in the third world. What we're talking about when we're talking about poverty in the third world is something that the economists call absolute poverty. What we mean by absolute poverty is the state of affairs in which clothing, shelter, or food is unavailable at some point during the year to a person. That is, that being able to count on those three basic elements of life, clothing, shelter, food, is something that the people can't do. That's called absolute poverty, and that's the way most economists measure poverty in the third world. That's obviously a different kind of poverty than exists in advanced industrial countries like our own. I think that doesn't at all make the kind of poverty that exists in the United States and in other advanced industrial countries any easier to take, because people mostly aren't starving to death, mostly have some clothes, mostly have some kind of shelter, and all of those can be very, very marginal even in the United States. There is in the advanced industrial nations the added dimension of the kind of psychological and community defined element, right, to poverty that is very real. And we can't simply dismiss it as not as bad as the third world. It's different. The dynamics are different in the United States. We might want to talk about that a little bit. Anyway, absolute poverty globally, struggle for survival, is now about 1.2 billion people out of, for round number purposes, out of 5 billion. Something like 23, state of the world says 23.4% of the global population, 1.2 billion. Interestingly enough, this same kind of trend that we've seen in the United States is also true about global poverty. That is, in general, there was it's a flatter curve. The reduction wasn't quite as dramatic as in the United States. But starting from a poverty rate of about 30% in 1950 globally, the rate declined to a low of, how far did it get down? It got down to about 21.5 in 1980. And is now back up toward 23.4 now. So also during the 80s globally, the decade was not good to poor people. Just a couple of other numbers globally to focus our attention just briefly, and I don't want to stay here very long, on the immense challenges in front of us. The numbers are staggering. Let me give you the numbers for Asia, Sub-Saharan, and then North Africa and the Middle East, Latin America. Asia has something like 600, and these are all really rough numbers, 675 million poor people, about 25% share of the population. Sub-Saharan Africa has the largest percentage of poor people. In those nations, something like 62% of the population is poor, 325 million total. The next largest percentage of poverty is in Latin America, so it goes Sub-Saharan Africa, just by percentage, Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America. 35% of the population is poor in Latin America, about 150 million people, and then North Africa and the Middle East, about 28% are poor, 75 million. So it seems to me that particularly when one begins to think about this rise in the rate of poverty over the last 10 years, and when one begins to put that together with what we know on an almost daily basis is a shrinking globe, where connections between those of us who live in advanced industrial countries and those of us who are better off, connections between us and the rest of the world are becoming clearer and clearer in their practical aspects every day. Well, I'm saying that we have a moral call to be involved with thinking about and acting on this question, but that we increasingly, morality aside, our Christianity aside, we increasingly have a call that really is about our self-interest, right? Which is really coldly calculated realism, because our fates are one. And because people who have to burn down or clear off parts of the Amazon forest, rainforest, in order to make a living, are affecting our global warming. Right? That we are connected with the questions of development and the desperation of poverty all over the globe. It seems to me to be just clearer and clearer every day. And for those of us in the United States, it seems to me we've had the false luxury, and we've worked pretty hard at keeping it this way, I think, too, of making poverty as invisible and separate from us as we possibly can. All of the measures, you know, a lot of social scientists have ways of measuring the kind of integration at a number of levels of a society. You talk about racial integration, you talk about economic integration. And by all of those measures, we're basically growing apart, further apart. The decade of the 80s was also a decade in which the races grew farther apart, I'm talking physically, living farther apart from each other, and where the classes grew farther apart, that is, more and more isolated from other classes of folks, so that the poor are more isolated, and so are the wealthy. That seems to me to be a set of illusionary practices which isolates us from the realities that we really have to be dealing with. Well, enough of this overall contextual stuff. What I want to do today is to think with you briefly about the economic aspects of this question, and particularly the question around the creation of good work. It seems to me if you think about poverty, you can think about it as being defined in a number of different ways. You can think about poverty. We spent a lot of time yesterday thinking about social service systems and the growth of the social welfare system in the United States and in Western Europe, and the kinds of problems that creates for the sort of self-empowerment of poor people. And we thought through some alternatives in that regard. But that whole system is based on a definition of poverty which says that basically the problem with poor people is that they don't have the right characteristics. And those characteristics could be not enough education or not good enough health, but somehow there's something in the character of the poor and what they have that needs to be serviced and helped. So therefore, poverty is also the need for services, right? That's a lot of how we've been defining poverty in the United States. But you could think about poverty as either a lack of power, which we began to think about yesterday, or where our focus is a little bit more today, poverty, in a very simplistic way, is the lack of money. How about that? If you don't have enough money, you're probably poor, right? Let's just take that as a sort of basic starting point for today. And let me say that an awful lot of people who work in the area of alleviating poverty don't think that way anymore. It seems to me a fairly simple way to start, but it's hard to get folks back to the basics sometimes. If poverty is a lack of income primarily, then one of the things that really shapes the way in which poverty has grown is the huge changes, focusing just on the United States for a minute, that our economy has undergone in the last little while. What I want to do is break for just a minute and show you a brief 8 or 9 minute video. The video is about a community in Chicago, which is where I come from, and this is a case that we've been working on a lot in Chicago, which is about to lose 7,000 jobs. And I thought it would just be a good place to start our discussion about rebuilding work and rebuilding the economy for people who are getting locked out. This is a little piece from the McNeil-Lehrer report that was done a couple of months ago. And it raises, I think, a lot of the issues about the relationship between work and the creation of poverty. Let's just do that briefly and see if you got any reactions to it. I'd also love to, you know, hear from you briefly about whether or not this is happening where you are as well.
Low wage third world countries. Business correspondent Paul Salmon reports on a new tactic in Chicago.
Gonna fight together, we shall not lose.
Bet you haven't heard militant union songs like this in a while, but in the basement of a Chicago church, workers from a 76-year-old local firm, Stuart Warner, which manufactures industrial instruments, have come to make a desperate last stand. They're trying to prevent prevent BTR, the British conglomerate that bought Stuart Warner 2 years ago, from closing their plant down.
We're fighting for our country, we shall.
Among those in attendance are members of Joanna Sullivan's family.
Got to stop. All right.
These people work at one of Stuart Warner's two Chicago plants. BTR intends to move the work to Texas and Mexico. Local investors say they want to buy the factory to keep the work in town, but BTR won't sell. So the only hope of keeping the jobs in Chicago seems to be new legislation recently proposed by Alderman Bernie Hansen.
We've learned that the old methods of saving factory jobs just doesn't work. This time has come to create a new approach.
The new approach is a legal technique known as eminent domain, which simply means the city of Chicago would seize the Stuart Warner plant slated for shutdown. Then, the city would sell it to local investors.
Taking over a plant by eminent domain to keep it in town is a new tactic in the struggle between business and the community. But the struggle itself is an old one, pitting two very different economic perspectives against each other. On one side is the company, which shuts a plant because it views the economics narrowly in terms of maximizing its profits, cutting its losses. On the other side is the community. From its larger perspective, closing a plant is a total loss for its employees, for other local businesses, and even for taxpayers like you and me.
By using data from previous plant closings, it's possible to calculate what the Stuart Warner shutdown is likely to cost the community. So first, let's look at the loss to employees through the eyes of Joanna Sullivan's plan.
My sister got everybody in our family a job, cousin, sister, brother, husband, everyone. My sister got all of us jobs, Stuart Warner.
How many people altogether?
We have here, that's now 47.
But of the 47 family members who worked at the plant, only 14 are left. Five of them are here at the table. BTR has laid off more than 1,000 workers since it took over in 1987.
Some of them have went to GA, our general assistant from welfare, and some of them are just doing day work or just working day by day on whatever from the Job Corps.
We asked Joanne Sullivan how many people had found jobs.
Not too many. My son, he had a job, but it's not like this.
It certainly isn't. These people average nearly $10 an hour plus benefits. And how much does Sullivan's son make?
I don't know. I didn't ask.
Well, we asked. 45 hours a week as a janitor in this Southside apartment house, no pay at all. He just gets a small apartment to live in and survives on food stamps, courtesy of the taxpayer. But afraid of losing even this job and winding up homeless, he backed out of an interview. But at least he has some options. Unlike his aunt, Patsy Abston.
Because if I leave Stuart and Warner, if they lay me off today, how can I go anywhere and get a job?
Why not?
Because I've had one surgery in January and I've had four on one hand for the past 4 years. So I have tried to look for a job and I cannot work because my hands don't work.
What can you do with your hands? Can you move them like this?
Mm-hmm. I can turn them just like that. That's it.
And that's from Stuart Warner?
That's from being a punch press operator, Stuart Warner, for the past 24 years.
And as a result of that, you can't get a job?
I cannot get a job.
Greg LeRoy has been studying plant closings for years. Some of the most substantive information on laid-off workers comes from his Midwest Center for Labor Research.
Effectively, what you have among a lot of the senior workers, especially, is that they never significantly re-enter the workforce. Maybe they get casual labor, maybe they go to the underground economy, maybe they just have de facto retirement and live off the income of relatives and family members.
LeRoy has been calculating the costs of plant closings to the community for years. We asked him to run the numbers for the Stuart Warner plant. The workforce here is mostly female, largely black. Given the past history of similar workers, you can make statistically reliable predictions of how much layoffs here will cost the community over a two-year period. First, there are the increased costs of maintaining the social safety net. For example, Unemployment compensation is likely to cost the government, and hence the taxpayer, an additional $11.18 million. General assistance or welfare will add another million or so. And then there's the predictable rise in food stamps, another $424,000. In addition to more government spending, layoffs also lead to less government revenue. Less local tax revenue, for example. There are fewer and fewer workers to patronize local businesses, like the recently defunct Capricorn Beauty Salon or the local bar, Mark and John's.
Yeah, every time the people get laid off, everybody get hurt. All the business get hurt. Not only us, all around the area. Everybody get hurt.
Like who?
Like the gasoline station. There was another restaurant down the street. There was another tavern down there with. And we are the only one left.
But even Mark and John's is up for sale. Its demise, just a matter of time. An old, once vital neighborhood that depended on Stuart Warner for its economic survival is essentially going out of business. Now, according to our tally sheet, the drying up of local business will cost city and state government $6.6 million in decreased revenues over the two-year period. And add to that the loss of Illinois state income taxes, $1.9 million, and federal taxes, about $13.7 million. Since people don't pay income taxes when their income's gone. Emmanuel Rose is Joanna Sullivan's ex-husband. After 24 years at the plant, he was laid off in November, and his fortunes have sagged dramatically ever since. Rose can't find a job and has racked up more than $5,000 in medical bills.
When my bills don't get paid, I really do not know how. I'm not able to pay them.
Rhodes had to move in here with his daughter when he developed diabetes. Medicare and the Cook County Hospital, supported by the government, are footing the bill. And medical expenses like this correlate with unemployment.
It's typical to have higher rates of stress-related diseases. Stress-related diseases like cardiovascular problems, heart attacks, high blood pressure, ulcers, alcoholism, cirrhosis, the liver. All those have been shown in higher incidence among chronically unemployed dislocated workers. You get higher rates of suicide, spouse abuse, child abuse, mental health admissions, crime.
Now, it's awfully hard to quantify human suffering, but it's clear that all this trauma costs the community, and medical costs at least can be translated into dollars. So add Medicaid to the tally, $286,000, and now we can finally sum up. An increase in social safety net spending of $12.9 million, a loss of $22.2 million in taxes, and so the layoffs at Stuart Warner in the first 2 years can be estimated to cost the community about $35 million, or about $20,000 per worker. But of course, the company looks at the economics of moving from an entirely different perspective. For years, Stuart Warner has been keeping a low media profile, consistently ducking interview requests, afraid to inflame the debate, since a company's always on the defensive when it's leaving town.
The company today announced a long-awaited decision to close the plant down.
But in November, Stuart Warner issued a press release explaining in a nutshell the economics of closing its Diversey Street plant.
Because most of our competitors obtain their products from lower cost areas of the world, we have to move our operations in order to survive.
And when company president Wes Kiley finally agreed to talk to us, he emphasized the same calculation.
The average rate in our Chicago factory hourly rate is approximately $10 an hour. In Texas, we would be paying a couple dollars an hour less than that. And if for our assembly operations in Mexico, we'd be paying substantially less than that.
In fact, Stuart Warner has for years been moving work from Chicago to the duty-free Maquiladora region of Mexico, along the Texas border. Wages here are about $1 an hour. Since buying Stuart Warner 2 years ago, British conglomerate BTR has simply continued the process. Because when the company runs the numbers, it figures wage rates plus the cost of operating an old plant compared to starting anew in cheaper climes. And the bottom line is that moving will save the company $17 million a year.
I think that just as American industry has to adjust to world competition, so society has to adjust to those changes. The idea that we're going to do everything in 1990 the way we did it in 1960 in the same locations, we're kidding ourselves.
To Kiley and Company, you keep the business competitive by moving. But to the community, you preserve jobs by reinvesting in what you've got. And there's now an offer to buy the plant from a corporate lawyer who used to run Chicago's Economic Development Commission, Tim Wright.
They figure they can milk the company probably all the way up until there's nothing left, and then simply dismantle it, and it's gone. And I see a different future for Stuart Warner. I see a future of new markets. I see a future of new contracts. I see a future of new areas that they have not focused on. I see a dedicated workforce that is going to do all it can to make it work.
But BTR has refused even to talk to Wright for two reasons.
First of all, there's no reason for us to sell the business. We know how to run it to make a profit. But secondly, this man has, I still don't feel it's a legitimate offer. He has no track record in any of this. It's easy to say all those things for publicity in the newspapers.
BTR won't sell. And that gets us back to the Stuart Warner rally and the community's current hope, seizing the plant by eminent domain and selling it to a local investor. To Mark Miller, however, editor of Crane's Chicago Business, eminent domain would be economic self-destruction.
To me, the trouble with eminent domain is that it sends a very negative signal about the business climate of Chicago to the rest of the country and to the world. It says that in Chicago, if we don't like the decisions that a company makes, we seize the assets and sell them to somebody else. That is not going to be good for bringing future jobs into Chicago, not only for those who lost their jobs at Stuart Warner, but in Chicago broadly.
In fact, while we were at his office, Miller was just correcting the copy of his latest editorial, arguing that with eminent, you seize is what you get, an old factory on land the free market could put to better use. Better to let the plant close.
What's going to happen to this property now? The real estate will be sold and redeveloped to some purpose, either industrial or residential or commercial, and it likely will go back on the tax rolls.
Take the Clybourne Corridor in a renovated factory district not far from Stuart Warner. A shopping mall has moved in, restaurants, there are even some small manufacturers down the block. In other words, goes the argument, in the long run, a free market economy must clean out the old to make way for the new. The process may be brutal, even unjust, to the community and especially to the employees who lose their jobs, but according to the business argument, that's the price you sometimes have to pay in the difficult process of adaptation to a new world. The community, of course, disagrees, arguing that adaptation doesn't happen soon enough if it happens at all. This old food processing plant, for example, just a few miles from Stuart Warner, is still rubble 4 years after it closed. The change, says the community, is too wrenching, renewal too slow, the price to society just too high.
In the final economic analysis, however, it's simply a judgment call. Does the market produce so much more efficiently in the long run that it justifies its short-term brutality? Or can people in community manage the economic process more fairly while preserving the dynamism that keeps any economy alive? The analysis varies case by case, but the answer, in general, reflects basic beliefs, not numbers.
Any comments or reactions to that? Is that an unusual story these days? Do you know about those stories from your own communities?
The Schmidt Brewery in St. Paul closed about a month ago. The same thing.
Same story?
An Australian billionaire had bought out another company, which had bought it out and needed to make a profit on his buyout, and this is a plant that he could do away with.
Right.
So now it's closed.
Okay.
Detroit's a good example too. The motor companies moving to a place where they get cheaper labor. Mm-hmm.
Caterpillar tractors moved out of Ireland elsewhere across the U.S. to Chicago.
We just heard on our way in last week that McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis is closing a 5,000 person plant. So. Are any of you from parts of the country that are the recipients of these jobs? Not all of them go to the Maquiladora district in the Mexican border.
Yeah, that's what that guy's argument sounded kind of ridiculous. I mean, no one's coming in. They're all going to other countries. No one's coming in and developing new areas. I mean, well, they did show the one example. I just wonder how that measures up, what the statistics are on that.
Yeah.
They actually reconvert back into productive places that produce jobs.
Well, I have a question. Was the company still making a profit when they were functioning in Chicago? I think that's kind of a bottom line.
Yeah,
if they were making a profit there, then I think sure they should stay. But if they were actually losing money, then that's not a problem. But if they were talking about increasing their profit from a 10% profit to a 15% profit, I think then there's kind of a
mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about the way you phrased the question is, what do we mean by the company? The Stuart Warner plant was turning a profit.
Right.
And they were profitable as a company.
Yes.
But BTR, the British company that bought them, felt that they were not profitable enough when compared to their other holdings.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I really like that tape, and some of you are picking up some of the reasons why, because it combines in one simple case study, happens to be in our neighborhood, a story that it seems to me has at least four of the major elements of what's happening to all of our economy, and what seems to me absolutely earth-shaking changes. And I also love the way the correspondent ends the piece by saying, this is probably a matter of faith. This is probably a matter of belief to figure out where you stand on these questions. That seems to me to sort of throw it right back in our laps. And it seems to me absolutely right. This is not necessarily a set of questions that are at home in economics departments or necessarily in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. It seems to me that there has to be a way for communities of people to reappropriate these questions as questions that are appropriate for us to deal with. Let me just lift up what I think the four major trends in the economy are that sort of get exemplified in that little tape. One is something the economists call uneven development. That is, since about 1975, the way in which job development, economic development generally has taken place in the United States has had a markedly uneven character. That is, some areas have absolutely boomed, while other areas have absolutely busted. So you get in lots of cities, like my own of Chicago at this time, a booming downtown. Downtown has just exploded with wonderfully beautiful new buildings and doubled its retail space, doubled its office space over the last 15 years. That is now cheek by jowl next to absolutely devastated neighborhoods, right? And increasingly that's true about cities. So within cities, we have this kind of uneven development, boom and bust, right next to each other. Within regions, the same thing is true. Nationally, the same thing is true. You've got regions, whole areas of the country that have in lots of ways gone bust, the industrial Midwest being one major example versus the Southwest with a major boom. So that you've got, and certainly internationally, that is, the flow of capital as recently as 10 years ago was markedly north to south globally. In the last 6 or 7 years, that flow of capital, that is, the overall wealth balance between north and south globally has reversed, so that now the poor countries of the south send more money in debt payments to the northern industrial countries than the northern industrial countries send south in either loans or investments. Right? So even on a global scale, the development has taken on an increasingly uneven character. So that's number one. That seems to be captured by the tape. Second, you've all pointed to it already. Here we've got a British company, a Chicago plant in a Mexico location. Right? You've got this kind of increasingly global and rapidly moving character of capital, in particular, of investment capital. Capital has gotten remarkably mobile. It used to be, in my town of Chicago, that you could tell who the wealthy folks were, and they were all Chicagoans. I mean, when we had our problems with our Potter Palmers and our Marshall Fields and our people who sort of owned the city and built the industry on which the city was built, but at least they were Chicago people. And you knew they were there, and they had a stake in Chicago, and you could deal with them, right? Now we're not sure in Chicago who owns what, right? And it could be a British company that owns the local plant that's about to move it to Mexico. So the mobility of capital, the mobility of investment capital, chasing mostly cheap labor, but a lot of other conditions as well, is a major shift in what's happened. That's fairly recent. Certainly the acceleration of it is recent. Third, this tape points to, it seems to me, what we're all acquainted with over the last 15 years, the increasingly massive size of the significant economic actors in our society. The Fortune 500 if we would look at the amount of capital controlled by the Fortune 500 10 years ago, as opposed to the Fortune 500, the largest corporations today, the increase, it's almost doubled. What we're saying is the average size of the business, therefore the span of control, has gotten more global and huge. BTR doesn't care a whole lot about the neighborhood in which Stuart Warner is located, or about the 6,000 or 7,000 workers that's going to affect. And that's true more and more. It certainly was true in the brewery case that you talked about in Milwaukee. So the massive increase in the size of enterprises. And then what we began to see here it seems to me, probably the overall effect of these changes to decrease markedly the industrial sector of our economy, the point at which people are actually making things, and increase the service sector of the economy. You all know about that sort of major change, but that's really made a huge difference to all of us, it seems to me. There are more jobs in 1990 than there were in 1980. But there are many hundreds of thousands fewer industrial jobs of the $10 an hour kind that Stuart Warner represented. And there are many, many more service sector jobs. And interestingly enough, it seems to me, what we're beginning to understand now about service sector jobs is that they are really of two markedly different sorts. That at the top end of service sector, you've got a top end and you've got a bottom end. At the top end of the service sector jobs, there are about one-third of the newly created jobs that are created for folks who go through college, who get increasingly sophisticated degrees, who get credentialed at an increasingly sophisticated level, and whose rewards are increasingly well-paid work. Right? A lot of the people who work at least on the top floors of those booming downtowns that I was just talking about get paid awfully well. We're talking, you know, this was the decade of the yuppies, right? And that wasn't just a cliche that was sort of born out of nothing. There is a class of people who are making more money than any class of people, at least that young, have ever made before in their lives. Tom, what do law school graduates at the top firms get now?
They make about $80,000.
$80,000 right out of law school. Right. So not all of this one third is that way, but certainly a lot of that top edge. And we tend to think about, when we think about the switch from an industrial economy to a service economy, we often kind of think about these jobs. But in fact, the vast majority of jobs that are getting created these days in the service economy, the two-thirds of the jobs, are not of that character at all. In fact, they are at exactly the opposite end of the spectrum. They are low-paying, they are dead-end with no prospect of advancement, right? And they require the opposite of what an education is supposed to do for somebody. That is, they offer a kind of moronification of people or something, is that a word? The creation of morons, the McDonaldization of the workforce, right, is what we're talking about here. And what is it that McDonald's wants to do with its workforce? It wants to make it temporary, low-paid, and totally mobile, right? So that you can plug in new people into a McDonald's about every 6 weeks. I think that is the average tenure of a worker in a McDonald's. If that's all you've got a worker for, you've really got to put that worker at the service of some very simple tasks that get defined by machines. Well, not all of those jobs are McDonald's, but there is a whole sector of the job market which is like that, and which has then, as it's expanded, enlarged in the United States beyond anything I think we've seen in recent decades, the category that we call working poor. So what you've got then is a real shift in the old American ladder of opportunity. I just sketched a little one little version of the old American opportunity ladder here, where you would come into a city most often if you were an immigrant or a migrant from the South or whatever else. You would come in and probably find a low-paying subsistence kind of job that doesn't require much in the way of education. Doesn't even, for many of our ancestors, doesn't even require them to speak English, right? You would move to that into a kind of job that had a little bit more stability, but at least to put bread on the table. At least to put bread on the table on a fairly regular basis. And it wasn't dead end. It led up. If you did what you needed to do, if you were stable, if you proved yourself, you could get a kind of stability in a blue-collar job that led you up the ladder, and that many people became, what the economists would call maybe initial accumulators, where you would begin to put together a car and the beginnings of ownership of a bungalow of some kind, and begin to get some kind of stash of earthly goods that you could depend on for a while. And then some people could move even beyond that to the stage of being rapid accumulators, where you have enough capital to invest yourself and where money begins making money itself. Right? And that is the classic ladder of opportunity. And in lots of ways, American cities worked in this way, at least for large numbers of people. There's problems here, at this point, our video is telling us, at a number of levels. There's problems, first of all, getting on the ladder at all. Right? There aren't enough new jobs that have any relationship to further steps on the ladder at the very base of this ladder. The number of jobs at Stuart Warner, for instance, which could gainfully employ people who didn't finish high school but were perfectly willing to put in a full day's work for the sake of family and perfectly willing to be productive workers, but without much training except for on-the-job training. Those jobs used to be the classic entry-level jobs of industry, and they're not there anymore. So even getting onto the subsistence ladder is now tough. Moving from the subsistence step of the ladder to some kind of stability is tough. So that people who, and because a lot of these jobs are increasingly, or what used to be these jobs, are increasingly sort of in the service sector, people can get them for a while and then find themselves sort of stepping back down into poverty for a while. So that growing class of the temporary poor. And not too many people can get by this border anymore into beginning to accumulate some kind of initial stash that gives them some ownership in the American dream. That really has changed things, it seems to me, in communities across the country. Well, let me just end with a couple of a couple of comments on what I think we might do about this. We've been talking about the problem here, and I want to ask you to join the conversation at the point of thinking about what to do. Let me say five easy things about what this means for me in terms of a policy agenda as we rethink where we are nationally, and then a couple quick examples of what excites me, which is really local folks taking a Stuart Warner-like situation, dross, and making gold out of it, which I think can be done locally. I'm not sure we're quite there in the United States yet where we can do much nationally. But if we were, we would be thinking about, it seems to me, we would be thinking about a policy agenda that might come out of our faith. Let me go back to that for just a second and suggest that as Christians, we've got at least three standards that we can hold our economic agenda to. One I talked about already, that is Jesus' example of concern for the poor. John Schramm, I think this morning, talked about Jim Wallace and others who are now asking that every development scheme be run by the criteria, what does this do for the poorest of the poor? And if it doesn't touch him, forget about it. It's not worth putting any time in it. So the concern for the poor is at the core of it seems to me, as Christian people. Secondly, it seems to me that we can get all kinds of support for a concern for community, a concern for the possibility that people can enter into lasting relationships with each other, some understanding of a collective well-being that we ought to bring out of our Christian experience, that allows us to at least ask some questions about a Stuart Warner and about whether or not there's a sense of responsibility to community there. And thirdly, it seems to me that theologically we might be able to begin thinking about an interpretation that places a good deal of importance on the character of good work. That is, work that isn't just, I've been pretty narrow here, isn't just work that provides an income and therefore puts bread on the table, but work that is actually sustaining and creative and productive for the larger community. Not just a job in some way or other, but a calling. We might, as Christian people, think about those as criteria that we bring to the policy discussion. And then, therefore, ask ourselves that we look for policies that enhance structures that promote economic justice, build community, and enable good work. Those three simple things. Well, what does that mean? We can't talk that way very much in Washington, D.C. We can talk in Washington, D.C., though, about particular policy directions that grow out of those concerns. So I'm interested in retention of jobs. I'm interested in a set of approaches that would allow us somehow to root a Stuart Warner in community. Some kind of plant closing legislation, the possibility of local buyouts, the eminent domain kind of solution that we were thinking about in Chicago. That's probably not going to work with Stuart Warner, but it might in the next plant closing case, the Brock Candy Company, which is a little bit further west in Chicago. So I'm interested in all kinds of legislation and policy initiatives in that direction. I'm interested, as lots of people are, in what's called conversion of the economy. That is, some way of thinking about the huge amount of creative economic energy that we've put into the military machine over the last 35 years, and ways of converting that into domestic production that all of the economists tell us can produce more jobs and have more kind of spin-off economic benefits that build community than any military ends can do. This is aside from the question about the uses of military. I'm talking about the economic consequences of investing in military production versus domestic production. Thirdly, I'm interested in all kinds of policies that flatten and democratize work and the organization of work. Lots of corporations are interested in that as well these days. But involve people who do the work into making decisions about the work. Right? Holden is a wonderful place for sort of experimenting with that way of approaching work. Stakeholder power, giving the folks in who are major stakeholders in what is done in a work site, some decision-making power about what that work site does. Fourthly, I'm terrifically interested in job creation efforts that are rooted in community. I'll say a little bit more about that maybe. And fifthly, I'm interested in the huge challenges in education and training that have to reconnect a huge segment of our population, which now has been cut off from what will be the 21st century economy, because our education system has also fallen apart. Okay. Those five policy directions, it seems to me, are sort of clusters of things that get called to my mind out of the Stuart Warner experience. Me, as a last thing, just tell you one or two quick stories about things that make me incredibly hopeful. Internationally, I said this yesterday, and I want to repeat it because I think it's important. Internationally, people in the third world have learned so much quicker than we have how to do development work that rebuilds economy for poor people. The people internationally just know how to do that better than we know how to do it in rural areas and cities of the United States. One example, the most exciting economic institution in the world is, to me, is clearly the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Do people know the Grameen Bank story?
Yeah.
It's just, it is amazing. A tale about how one financial institution with not much money can involve literally millions of people in economic development work, and millions of the poorest people of one of the poorest countries in the world, with loans that average $64, right? That's the average amount of the loan given out by the Grameen Bank for the capital accumulation that leads people into individual entrepreneurial activities, to start a business. Mostly women get $64. to buy whatever it is they need. And they're supported by groups of other women. And none of the other women can get their loans, you know the general principle, right? Until the first woman has begun the payback schedule. And their collection on the loans is at a 98% rate, much higher rate than any bank around the world that lends to the middle class. The Grameen Bank, it seems to me, is an absolutely filled with genius set of experiments. We've got a bank in Chicago, the South Shore Bank, which is a neighborhood development bank, which has modeled some of its operations on the successes of the Grameen Bank and thinks about itself as a development bank in the United States kind of setting. Talk a little bit about that. Let me just tell you a quick story about this group, the Midwest Center for Labor Research, which was featured slightly in the Stuart Warner piece. One of the things that they have done, seeing the closing of plants in the west side of Chicago, the poorest neighborhoods of the city of Chicago, is they said, well, why are these plants, this is very creative thinking, it wasn't mentioned in the tape, why are these plants closing? So they went out and talked to the owners of all of the plants that employed from 25 to 100 people. So they weren't dealing with the huge Stuart Warners on the west side of Chicago, but the 25 to 100 employee shops out there. And they interviewed the owners. And the overwhelming, and of those who intended in the next decade, who thought that there's a possibility they would close the plant in the next decade, something like 60% said, well, the reason we're closing, or the reason we're thinking about closing, is because there's nobody to take it over. Right? These are mostly people who started their own plants or inherited from their ancestors, fathers, right? And they it's their little shop, right? They've worked in it for their entire lives, and for whatever reason, there's nobody in their family to pass it on to. Right? And it's not that they want to close or move or sell to somebody who's bigger than them outside of the community. They'd love to have it in the community. So what Midwest Center did was to set up a wonderful little program called the Chicago Focus, where they found local, mostly black and some Latino, entrepreneurs, gotten them the capital and, when necessary, some training. But these were basically capable people, and matched them up with the sellers. Right? So that you've got a kind of a marriage going on between already existing jobs and community leaders who will keep those jobs in the community. I think there's a lot of that kind of creative work that we can do. I told a little bit of story yesterday on the job creation front about the remarkable work that a group like Bethel New Life is doing on the west side of Chicago. They're a little Lutheran church, 30 members 25 years ago. They now employ 450 people in a very, very poor community on Chicago's west side. Run a series of businesses, do job training and education in a variety of ways, which connects people with real jobs. What I'm saying is, it's possible to think about rebuilding the economy from the bottom up and thinking about policies, which is going to have to be sort of in new categories, that support that rebuilding of the economy from the bottom up. And I hope that the end of the Reagan era is a time that's a break enough in our old thought patterns that we're able to rethink those questions. Let me stop there. We're about at the end of our hour, but there might be time for a couple of comments, questions, stories of other possibilities that you see out there. Reactions?
George, I have one reaction to your thing about good work. I think that's a wonderful way of thinking about the whole situation, because it works not only for creating jobs for the people who are having trouble getting into the subsistence level, but it says something about responsibility for the people who are in rapid accumulation. That good work, when you're wealthy, should have the same characteristics as good work when you're not wealthy, and that includes responsibility to your community and care for the people around you, so that it's a concept that isn't potentially isn't class related, and potentially is destructive of class. So I think it's a wonderful way of thinking about what needs to be done.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a challenge to this sort of ordinary way of thinking about work as simply income producing, and in the United States, income producing for what? For consumption. right? And if you think about consumption as the sort of center of part of our ecological problem, it's a way of getting at that issue as well. Yeah. Thanks, Ian.
How about like not so much capitalism, but more union-owned stuff?
Uh-huh. I think that worker-owned enterprises are another interesting set of experiments, different ways of structuring that going on all over the place. It's an option to buyouts. I mean, there are different kinds of buyouts, and one kind of buyout is by the multinational corporation. Another kind of buyout is by the workers who, you know, not only have worked in the plant, but will still be working in the plant. They will still be at least living in the community. Yeah.
Still, though, even with, aside from the moral questions and trying to convince those in power to change the way things are run, it seems still in the free market system itself that profit motive makes closings inevitable. You know what I mean? The only way to keep plants going is to make them profitable somehow. And I don't know how you can overcome that as long as there are these huge corporations that are constantly buying out. Because, I mean, for example, a Schmidt Brewery in St. Paul, the workers are willing to take a $2 an hour cut in pay, give up half their benefits, those all these other investors are going to do it, but still, you know, just the accountant said, no, it's more profitable for us just to close the thing, regardless of what you're willing to do.
Not only just to close it, but to close it and not allow you to buy it.
Yeah, that's right.
They didn't want a dollar for it.
Yeah.
The thing that scares me is that I think what's going to happen now, and I don't know if your data show it yet, that profitable companies are going to get hit and closed because of the crazy finances of the 80s. You got companies like Florsheim Shoe, which is a very profitable, good, job-creating, community-based company, took on all this debt to avoid a leveraged buyout, and it's about to go out of business because it can't handle the debt. So I have this terrible fear that, when there was a change in national leadership in 80, I was deathly afraid we were all going to die by nuclear incineration. In fact, I think what's happened is that the whole economy is grinding to a halt under the income shifts that were made in the 80s. I think that there was no linking of all that to any kind of economic progress or job creation. I'm really afraid that that's going to be a real challenge in terms of job creating or job retention, is to deal with the debt that's all over the place.
Yeah. But even that could be an opportunity to rethink
stuff.
There are lots of ways
to do it.
Yeah. Right. Okay, thank you all. I think
thanks,
that's dinner.
Thank you.